Okay, welcome back to Healthspan. This is part 10 of Outlive by Dr. Peter Attia. In this episode, I'll be finishing up the nutrition section of the book and also be talking about the awakening, how to learn to love sleep, the best medicine for your brain. So I talked about carbohydrates and protein already. The next category is fats. There are, broadly speaking, three types of fats: saturated fatty acids, monounsaturated fatty acids, and polyunsaturated fatty acids. The difference between these three different types of fats has to do with the saturation, which is simply the amount of hydrogen atoms that are attached to each of the carbon chains. With polyunsaturated fatty acids, we make one more important distinction between them, which is omega-6s and omega-3s. We can further subdivide omega-3s into EPA and DHA and also non-marine sources like ALA. From our empiric observation and what he considers the most relevant literature, which of course is less than perfect, we try to boost monounsaturated fatty acids close to 50 to 55% while cutting saturated fatty acids down to 15 to 20% and adjust total polyunsaturated fatty acids to fill the gap between these MUFAs and also SFAs. We also boost EPA and DHA, those fatty acids that are likely really important for the brain and also our cardiovascular health, with marine fat sources and or supplements. So putting all these changes into practice typically means eating more olive oil and avocados and nuts and cutting back, but not necessarily eliminating the butter and lard, and also reducing the omega-6 rich corn oil, soybean oil, and also sunflower oil, while also looking for ways to increase, again, the high omega-3 marine polyunsaturated fatty acids from sources like salmon and anchovies. So anytime I talk about fats, I keep it very simple. We talk about the big four, which is olive oil, nuts, avocados, and also fish, including salmon. The most comprehensive review of fats was from a study in 2018 from the Cochrane Collaboration, and it was titled Polyunsaturated Fatty Acids for the Primary and Secondary Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease. This was a 422-page summarization of all the relevant literature from 49 studies randomized over 24,000 patients, and it drew the conclusion that increasing polyunsaturated fatty acids probably makes little or no difference to our risk of death and may make little or no difference to our risk of dying from cardiovascular disease. However, increasing polyunsaturated fatty acids probably slightly reduces our risk of heart disease events and of combined heart and stroke events. There was also another study out of Cochrane in 2020, which was a 287-page paper titled Reduction in Saturated Fat Intake for Cardiovascular Disease, and it looked at 15 different randomized control trials in over 50,000 patients and found, among other things, that reducing dietary saturated fat reduced the risk of combined cardiovascular events by 17%. The same review also found little or no effect of reducing saturated fat on all-cause mortality or cardiovascular mortality. So the evidence is strong, but it's not a causation type of thing we're looking at. So of course, fats are important, but of course we want to focus on getting the protein amounts and also focusing on the main polyunsaturated fats and getting enough EPA and DHA. The next section is all about time restriction. So I talked about calorie restriction, I talked about diet restriction, and then there's time restriction. There's no denying that some good things happen when we are not eating. We know insulin drops, we know our liver is emptied of fat, we know we go into a more starvation mode and activate AMPK, activate FOXO3, which is the cellular repair genes, and also we downregulate mTOR. And in short, fasting triggers many of the physiologic and cellular mechanisms that we want to see. Of course, is it recommended to all patients? Not necessarily. The original 16-8 model that many intermittent fasters talk about, meaning you go 16 hours without eating and 8 hours of a feeding window, a lot of these studies came from mice, and the study found that mice fed in only the 8-hour window and fasted for the 16 were healthier than the mice that were fed continuously. The time-restricted mice gained less weight than the mice that ate whenever they wanted. And remember that a 16-hour fast for a mice is really akin to a multi-day fast for a human. So we have to always take my studies with a grain of salt. Another drawback is that you're virtually guaranteed to miss your protein target with this approach. If you only have 8 hours throughout the day to consume food, it's likely that you're not going to reach your 1 gram per kilogram amount of protein that we necessarily want to maintain our muscle mass. It's very easy to fall into the trap of overindulgence during your feeding window and also mindlessly consume. So again, it's the idea that, oh, I have this 8 hour window and I can eat whatever I want in that 8 hours. And as long as I'm in that feeding window, then whatever I eat doesn't matter. So a lot of people have that approach. The same thing goes for the alternate day fasting, where you will eat for a day and then fast for a day. And one small but revealing study found that subjects on the alternate day fast did lose weight, but they also lost a lot of lean mass than subjects who simply ate 25% fewer calories every day. So this kind of goes to show that in alternate day fasting, you're not getting your protein. And also on top of that, the alternate day fasting group had also lower activity levels during the study, which suggests that they were not feeling very good on the days that they were not eating. So I don't necessarily recommend alternate day. I think the 16-8 hour is a better approach, or even a better approach is doing a 24 to 32 hour fast just once a week and trying to consume as much food in a time-restricted window as you can, but also maintaining the right amount of protein intake. So that's sort of the conclusion, the CRDRTR. These are just tools to reduce energy intake, to correct the state of being overnourished and or metabolically unhealthy. Remember, most people will be overnourished but also under-muscled, and it is counterproductive for them to limit calories at the expense of protein and hence muscle mass. And I just want to quickly read verbatim the last paragraph in this chapter. And if you are reading this chapter, you're upset because you quite agree with some details he's covered, be it like the ratio of MUFA to PUFA or the exact bioavailability of soy protein or lectins or the ideal target for average blood glucose, or if Dr. Peter Attia has offended your diet, saying that your diet's not the best diet. He just has one final piece of advice, which is stop overthinking nutrition so much and really just go out and exercise. So I feel like towards the end of this chapter, he kind of just gave up and realized we're never going to reach a point where everyone agrees on a diet. Instead, you want to do what's best for you. You want to look at energy balance, the calorie restriction, time restriction, diet restriction, and find out what works for you. And if it works for you, great. That's sort of like the summary of that nutrition section. And I quickly want to cover just the sleep section. I've talked about sleep extensively in other podcasts, but because he talks about it here, I'll cover it. So how to learn to love sleep and the best medicine for your brain. He begins this chapter talking about when he was a resident and he used to do 120 hours a week. So he was a surgical oncologist, and he would do 120 hours in his residency in Baltimore. And he tells a funny story about how it's not necessarily a funny story, it's kind of a dangerous story, where he fell asleep behind the wheel. Luckily, he didn't crash. He also decided to take a nap at a park and ended up staying there for 6 hours and was just kind of surrounded by open air heroin market and a thriving hub for prostitution. Basically, he was so sleep deprived, he fell asleep on a bench for 6 hours when he didn't intend to. And he also fell asleep in his car with the radio on, and his wife had to come save him. So it goes to show the sleep deprivation, its impact on our health. And the Socratic question is, if sleep is so unimportant, he asked, then why hasn't evolution gotten rid of it? The science of sleep has taken off really in the last 3 decades, and newer findings suggest that this attitude of I can sleep when I'm dead is exactly wrong. We know that sleep is fundamental to our health, and is as stability is for fundamental strength. So it's so important to our health. It's akin to having stability for strength. And he goes and talks about when he was not so thin, Peter. Remember during my first couple episodes, I talk about how Peter was definitely not in the best shape of health, emotionally or physically. And he had elevated insulin, high triglycerides, low testosterone. And he always attributed his poor health and hormone imbalance to a lousy diet and diet alone. But over the past decades, he kind of akins it to more just of a sleep deprivation. He was so sleep deprived, and even showed in his face how chronic lack of sleep really affected his entire metabolism and also his appearance. And poor sleep wreaks havoc on our metabolism. We know sleep researchers at the University of Chicago subjected healthy young people to severe restricted sleep, just 4 to 4.5 hours a night, and found that after 4 days, they had an elevated insulin level of obese, middle-aged diabetics, and yet, even worse, approximately 50% reduction in their capacity for glucose disposal. Similar risk associations have been found between poor or short sleep and also hypertension, cardiovascular disease, coronary heart disease, and obesity. This association between sleep and metabolic health seems puzzling at first, but I think the missing link here, as he puts, is stress. High stress levels can make us sleep poorly, and poor sleep also makes us more stressed. So it's a feedback loop. Both poor sleep and high stress activate the sympathetic nervous system, our fight or flight system, and increase our cortisol level, and it ultimately leads us to bad sleep and a bad cycle. The studies by Eve Van Couter group have found that limiting subjects to sleep to just 4 to 5 hours a night also suppresses their leptin levels. This is the hormone that is the satiety hormone, and we know that leptin levels will go down, causing us to eat more, and also ghrelin levels will go up, causing us to eat more. Sleep, as I mentioned, is bad for our cardiovascular system. The Mendelian randomization data confirmed the observational findings that sleeping less than 6 hours a night was associated with about a 20% higher risk of heart disease. We know sleep is important for the brain. He again talks about the glymphatic system, and this was a system discovered by researchers in Rochester some few years ago, that our brain activates a sort of internal waste disposal system that allows our CSF to flood in between the neurons and sweep away the intracellular junk like amyloid and also tau that build up in our neurons. Again, these are correlated with Alzheimer's and dementia. And he also says that, unfortunately, our ability to obtain deep sleep declines with age, beginning as soon as our late 20s and or early 30s, but worsening as we enter middle age. And one possible contributor to this age-related reduction in deep sleep is changes in growth hormone secretion. So growth hormone is typically released in a pulsatile manner about an hour after we begin to sleep at nighttime. And growth hormone reaches its peak during adolescence, and we know it rapidly declines between young adulthood to middle age, and then declines more slowly after that. So we don't know if it's the growth hormone problem or what exactly is going on, but there's a lot of contributing factors to why, as we get older, the sleep becomes harder and harder, not only falling asleep, but also staying asleep. Let's see what else he says in this section. Yeah, sleeping better. He gives the general rules. He keeps things very broad. We know we want, the first requirement for good sleep is darkness. He talks about temperature. He talks about cutting back the alcohol levels. He gives different tips in here. Coffee, of course, is not a solution to the problem of poor sleep. He also talks about the idea of sleep pressure. Again, if you want a more elucidated ideas and explanation of sleep, I recommend Why We Sleep by Dr. Matthew Walker. I covered this book before. He also talks about sleep pressure. I believe he came up with this idea. The concept of sleep pressure, our need to or desire to sleep, is key to many of our sleep tactics. We want to cultivate sleep pressure, but in the right amounts, at the right time, not too much, not too little, and also not too soon. He talks about exercise, having strong daylight during the day, so getting exposure to bright light during the day, and also, again, turning off your lights at nighttime, and just preparing for sleep, like getting off electronics. He gives very basic advice on how to improve your sleep. Again, there's no hidden miracle that he has in here. He keeps it very basic about how to get good sleep. So after ignoring sleep for decades, he's now a fan. He considers it a kind of performance-enhancing substance, not only physically, but also cognitively. We cannot overestimate the importance of sleep. So again, get your 7-8 hours, really focusing on quality sleep as well as quantity. And that's it. So I'll go ahead and leave the podcast here. Next episode will be my last episode of this book, and it's going to be all about emotional health. It's probably my favorite section of this entire book. So I recommend you tune in next week for the last episode of this book, where I talk about Peter's emotional journey. So thank you for listening. Hope you tune in next time, and I'll see you then.